We have two bills up today, and I've had a lot of questions about the fact that these bills are also up tomorrow and also up on Thursday. Just to settle that, the intention being, since we are at the point in the session where we need to get agendas approved at the Speaker's office, it was our thought that anticipating this might take more than one day to hear and to move on, that it would be easier to set these in advance, get approval for the agendas, rather than to go back every day. So that was all the mystery and magic about that. Nothing to it. Having said that, what I want to do today is open a public hearing on both bills, 819 and 550, so we can have a free-flowing discussion about the school fund issues as they relate to both bills. And so witnesses who come up don't need to worry about confining themselves to one particular bill, but can talk about both if they need to. And so with that said, let me open a public hearing on Senate Bill 550 and Senate Bill 819. Remind me to close both when we get done. And Steve, if you'll give us the staff overview, and then Senator Devlin, why don't you come forward? We'll let you lead off after the staff report.
Mr. Chair, members, Senate Bill 550A deals with primarily two topics. One is high cost funding for disability students. The other is high transportation costs for certain districts. What the bill does is to create a high-cost disabilities grant as part of the state school formula. Currently, the formula is made up of three separate grants: a general purpose grant, a transportation grant, and a facilities grant. This would add a high-cost disabilities grant as part of the formula. And it takes $12 million of state school fund dollars and puts it into a high-cost disabilities account for funding the disabilities grant. And so that would remove $12 million from the general purpose portion of the formula. And that requires then that those funds be used to pay the approved special education costs. And it sets a floor that the costs have to exceed four times the general purpose grant per weighted student to be eligible for the high-cost disability funds. So the first four times, or about $19,000 or $20,000, would be the district's cost. Anything above that would be considered high cost and would be eligible for refunding from the high-cost disabilities account. If the eligible costs exceed the $12 million that would be in the fund, then the cost would be prorated among the districts so that the total would not exceed the $12 million. And if the $12 million wasn't used, then that those remaining funds would be eligible to go back into the general purpose portions of the formula. So that's the high-cost disability portion. The second portion is for high-cost transportation. It directs the Department of Education to calculate transportation costs per student and rank the districts from highest to lowest. For the top 10% of those districts, the transportation grant would be increased from 70% to 90% of their approved transportation costs. For the next highest 10%, it would be increased from 70% to 80%. The other part of this bill would be to repeal the out-of-state disabilities fund. Those students would then be eligible under the high-cost disabilities grant in place of the out-of-state disability fund. And it would take effect on July 1, 2003.
Okay.
Bill 819 be engrossed, and I want to remind you that it has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means currently. It deals with local option revenue and how much local option revenue can be raised per student without it counting as local revenue in the school equalization formula. Currently, there's a 10% of the formula revenue, or $500 per weighted student, the lesser of those two amounts, that can be excluded or not counted as local revenue in the formula. The bill proposes to increase the 10% to 15% and the $500 to $750. So it would allow more local option revenue without becoming local revenue, counted as local revenue in the formula. The other part of this bill deals with small high schools that would merge. Currently, if two small high schools merge, they might not qualify as a small high school any longer and consequently would lose money from the merger. What the bill does is to say that if two small high schools, or if two small high schools or a small high school and a regular size school merged, that there wouldn't be any loss in funds from a reduction in the additional students that would normally have been attributed to the small high school. So it's trying to remove a disincentive to merger for small high schools.
All right. Thank you very much. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee here this morning, I'll try to give a combination of pre-prepared testimony and extemporaneous testimony to perhaps respond to some of the issues that I think may come forward. I think both of the bills come to you here, Senate Bill 550 and Senate Bill 819, with strong support from the state Senate. Both passed by overwhelming numbers. 819, I think, was 26-2, and I think that the other one was close to that. And they both passed out of the Senate Revenue Committee unanimously. The both bills, I believe, are very worthy of your support. One of the things I'd like to talk about in general is how the bills came forward and, in general, what the need is for them. And I'm going to digress from my written testimony here to just talk a little bit about, I think everybody here, being a member of the Revenue Committee, understands the history of school funding, understands the passage of Measure 5, understands what the impact of Measure 47 and the impact of Measure 50 were in terms of slowing the amount of property tax dollars going to schools. And although the decline in those dollars are offset by general fund dollars, that further exacerbates the issue of funding services at the state level. In 1999, after much discussion and a great deal of debate, the legislature passed a local option for schools. In fact, there was so much debate about that particular measure, although it passed by, I think, fairly good margins, that the governor was questioning whether or not to sign the bill. And ultimately, Governor Kitzhaber at that time did sign the bill. Since that time, a number of jurisdictions have went out and sought local options. I believe currently 17 school districts have local options. Some of the popular wisdom about school districts being able to pass or not being able to pass school measures, I don't think are actually true anymore. While only 17 school districts have passed local options, over 50 school districts since the passage of Measure 47 and Measure 50 have passed school, I think 50 have passed, close to 50 have passed school bond measures. You can't practically find any area in the state where a school bond measure has not passed. So some of the popular wisdom about not being able to pass or being able to pass a school measure, I don't think are true anymore. When we considered a local option, we considered an adjustment in the local option in the Senate. Many measures were debated, some which had support, some which did not, some which would have actually been very dramatic in terms of their impact. The proposal to raise the level under Measure 5 from $5 to $7 and devote the entire difference between $5 and $7 to a local option would have clearly raised the issue of some districts being able to raise substantially more than other districts. But what we tended to craft and tried to craft was a modest adjustment in the local option which will meet the needs of school districts now and in the future. I'd like to point out that many school districts that pass local options will actually have to go back out and renew those local options next year. While some of those local options won't expire for another year after that, but because of the double majority requirement, many of those school districts will go out in the even-numbered year when there is a fairly good chance, obviously, in the primary election to get the double majority, and you don't need to get the double majority in the November general election. The 819 actually has two components, and I think staff has given a very good explanation of those. To just reiterate, the first component was a modest adjustment in the local option law. It was carefully crafted to retain the legislature's original intent in passing a local option in 1999. And the second component, which was to get rid of a disincentive that exists now, was for school districts that have small high schools that want to merge the two high schools that they might have in a school district to be able to do that without losing the extra weighting that they would receive for having a small high school for a period of 4 fiscal years. I think these measures received a great deal of debate in the Senate. In fact, actually, 819 was scheduled for 7 different hearings and work sessions in the Senate Revenue Committee, and I practically spent more time in the Senate Revenue Committee than I did in some of my subcommittees on ways and means. Finally, what I'd like to say here is that I do not consider the local option to be a solution to school funding. Many people have approached me and they've asked me, well, will this solve the school funding problem? No, it will not. Will it provide a tool to some school districts to solve part of the problem? Yes, it will. And I think we need to provide as many tools as we can to school districts, particularly during this time of more needs than we have resources. And that's why I proposed this legislation, and that's, I believe, why the Senate overwhelmingly passed it 26-2.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions for Senator Devlin? What's the problem?
Mr. Chairman, can I ask for one courtesy? Dr. Korach, the superintendent of the Lake Oswego School District, has to return to the school district shortly. If he can be the next person.
Bring him up next with John Marshall and Ozzie Rose.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You bet. Thank you for coming in. Then, having telegraphed my next call, let's invite up Ozzie Rose, John Marshall, and Dr. Korach. No, you don't.
My change now.
I'll let you decide who goes first. Dr. Korach, are you in you're on a schedule to get back, so why don't you go ahead?
Thank you. I appreciate that. Chair Satterwhite and members of the committee. I have a document that I hope is at your place. I'd like to give you some perspective on Lake Oswego's situation, but largely address the question of the local option. And so I'd like you to indulge me and let me say some things to you that you know, and I know you know them, but I want to say them again. And so if you look at the first page, I think we've never been in a situation where the reality of the importance of education and its fundamental importance to a free and democratic society is more a reality. A well-educated, reasoning, skilled citizenry is absolutely essential to our entire way of life. And that's in jeopardy right now across this country and definitely in Oregon. If we fail right now, it'll have a profoundly negative impact on things that we value and really cherish. I know you know that, and I know it's a challenging and difficult time. So what I'm saying to you, and can summarize and say, is that right to a quality education is important. I know you value it. I know that adequate and stable funding and reworking the tax system is what we have to eventually do. But if that can't be accomplished right now, then we need options. And schools are desperately in need right now. And I'm going to ask you to continue to be thoughtful. One of the things that we have heard out there, you know, in the hinterlands, Lake Oswego, is that there's a sense of hopelessness right now. And it's here, too. You know, what can we really do? The economy is bad. It is a very difficult time. Well, I've always maintained, if you can't give me the money I need, give me options. Give me flexibility. Because we're not helpless out there. I've said that about school reform. I've said about funding. It's the first thing I said to Norma Paulus when I was advisor to the state board when I started working with her. I've been the superintendent in Lake Oswego for 16 years. I've seen this for a long time. I've seen the good years in the late 80s. I've seen Measure 5 and, you know, the message of Measure 5. You remember it really well because it was very compelling. McIntyre did a great job. Taxes are going to go down, and the legislature will fix the problem because they've got 5 years to do it. Do you remember what year that was? November 1990. And so I'm asking you to consider our situation, and I'm going to ask you to consider something that I teach to my students. As a superintendent of schools, I'm very, very fortunate. I teach Scholars Alliance, which means I have classes on the weekend for parents and students, and you may have heard about that program because we got in the press because we got sued to have private students get into the program. But I also teach a Sunday seminar to honor students. And one of the things that we talk about is the notion of competing realities. The competing truths and competing realities. And the paradox of those competing truths is to reconcile those opposites, you have to embrace both realities. The test of a first-rate intelligence, that F. Scott Fitzgerald quote, is the ability to hold two opposing points of view in the mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function. I'm going to ask you to do that. I'm going to ask you to do the best that you possibly can for adequate, stable funding statewide. But I'm also going to ask you to provide school districts with the option of going for additional dollars locally. There's some stereotypes out there that I work with all the time. Do you know that Lake Oswego is the lowest funded school district from the state in the county? Do you know that? Because the funding formula has weights in it. We don't have very many kids in poverty. We don't have very many English as second language speakers. You know, what's weighted in the formula doesn't advantage us at all. And so we are literally the lowest funded district in the county. But we do a great deal locally. And I'm going to ask you to look at our situation briefly. I've got a kind of a fact sheet here, and I just can sum it up. We cut $3 million last year, and we're looking at a $6 million problem this year. I have employment contracts that I must honor next year. It doesn't do any good for you the governor to tell me that I just don't have to fund benefit increases and I don't have to fund salary increases because I have those contracts already and went into this year with those contracts. So our problem is $6 million. And that's a deep problem. Now, I would also say that school districts are different. Situations are different. The funding form, anytime you adjust the funding form, there's going to be winners and losers. You know that because the factors are different. Cost of living varies in different districts. Communities vary. Their values vary. What they expect and what they want vary. You may recall that because of my situation, my school board asked me to retire and unretire. Did you read any of that stuff? You know, the poster boy for PERS? You have a situation right now that if I was in a small school district in eastern Oregon, I would have had the right to do what? I could have retired and collected my full salary and collected my full purse because you realize that there's a unique situation in trying to get superintendents in some of those smaller communities so that you have superintendent leadership there in a very, very difficult superintendent market. There's a scarcity of superintendents. So you've made adjustments, and I think wise adjustments, for the circumstances. I'm asking you to look at these circumstances and give us the ability to try to work with our own community to make it through a very, very difficult time. It's not a long-term solution. I realize that. But I'd ask you then, my two recommendations is keep in mind that the basic allocation is most important because that's where you provide the foundation of what we need. And then I'm going to ask you to support the local option so that we have an opportunity to work with our community to do the best that we possibly can. And you've supported it in the past, and it's probably never been as critical as it is now. It'll help us stave off some of those $6 million in cuts.
All right. Thank you. Questions for Dr. Cora and Representative Berger.
That's all right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to know what kind of salary increases you feel you will be giving.
Well, I know what they are because they're part of the contract. Our salary increase for teachers for next year is a 3.5% increase. It was a three-year contract that we negotiated right before essentially everything went south. So that is contracted, and we know that that will be the increase that we will provide next year.
Representative Bridget?
It is possible, however, for you to ask your teachers to take a salary freeze.
We have been in those informal negotiations, that is correct, and we are, I can't talk about negotiations right now, but we're in those negotiations, and that is correct.
Thank you, Bridget.
You bet.
Anything else for Dr. Korach? All right, thank you for coming down.
Thank you.
You bet. Ozzie Rose, John Marshall, who's next? Dr. Korach, if you want to excuse yourself and head back, that's fine.
Thank you very much.
You've probably heard these guys before.
Meeting, getting back.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Ozzie Rose of the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators, and we supported both of these bills from the Senate. We worked on them over there. Have a couple ideas for 550, but the key issues, the expanding local option, give a little more authority or opportunity for local districts, that's been explained to you. The other part of that bill, 819, the encouraging or allowing an incentive for small schools to merge. There's one case now where two districts would like to merge their high schools, and they found they would lose their small school correction if they do that, and 819 will allow them to keep the small school correction for 4 years as they put those two high schools together. And it's the first time we've done anything in the way of incentives to districts for looking at realignment, and I encourage you to push that forward. We tend to do things by fiat rather than by incentive, and I think this is a good step.
To the carrot versus the stick approach?
Sir.
Yeah.
The other, on Senate Bill 550, there's two issues in there. We had two task force put together in the interim, as you know, one on small schools and one on special education. And on the small school side, the study report tells us that the small school correction that we have in the formula is not perfect, but it's relatively accurate. If you watch and look at those graphs, it's pretty close to reality. The one glaring difference for small schools is how much they spend on a per-student basis for transportation. And this effort, currently all schools get 70% of their approved transportation costs reimbursed. And that creates a situation which on a per-student basis, some districts get as high as $1,100 per student in transportation. Others have 40, I think the lowest was 42 in the 2000-2001. And what this measure does is say that the top 10%, the top, above the 90th percentile, which would be 20 districts, they will get 90 in expenditures, approved expenditures for transportation. They would get a 90% reimbursement. The next 80th to 90th percentile, that group would get 80%, and then those below would skip the 70 that we currently get. And that reduces the range from the 1,100 plus to 40 down to 389 to 40. So it's those 40 districts, it collapses that difference. And it isn't a lot of money. I think the total amount of money is about $750,000. Is that close to a million? Is that what you're saying? Okay. I think it from the study, it's one of the things that could be tweaked. None of these, by the way, are answers. We're not answering the problem. We're building little blocks, and hopefully someday we'll have the final answer. But these are tweaks that we believe help the situation. On Senate Bill 550, the other issue is the high-cost special ed student. And the formula is designed to try to spread money around to take care of the things that are not proportionally, the burdens that are not proportionally spread around school districts. And we do know that the very high-cost special ed students tend to congregate near metro areas because of other services that are available, so that there's a magnet effect there. But the other side of that coin is a single high-cost student in some small districts are a very significant problem. And so you have two issues. And the study said we should address that in some manner. And the bill as it's currently written says that we'll set aside $12 million a year, and we'll reimburse districts who are spending more than four times their general purpose grant. We'll reimburse them for approved costs above that for those students. since the bill came through the Senate, the four times the general purpose grant isn't a high enough bar to get done what we're trying to do. And we would suggest that you have a couple choices you can take. And probably philosophically the best choice is to decide on six times or five times the general purpose grant or whatever. We're going to suggest that for this biennium, you set the bar at $25,000. So we would reimburse districts for approved cost on individual students who cost more than $25,000. Have a very specific bar. And then sunset that at the end of this biennium and come back and rework it in terms of connecting it more directly to the formula in the future. But the $25,000 was a very specific number. Everybody can plan against that. And we think that makes it easier. But we also think we don't know this is the exact right answer, and that's why we're suggesting that you sunset this and come back to continue working on it in the next session.
You're proposing an amendment?
Yes.
Is anyone working on an amendment?
We've had meetings, and I think we came out of the meeting that somebody was supposed to be thinking about
okay.
it, but I don't know about yeah. Quite frankly, last time we had a meeting that we weren't absolutely committed to which way we wanted to go.
Okay.
And I want to go the way I'm telling you. I don't know. I think everybody's kind of on the same page. But,
okay.
Well, sure. One of the reasons we set this for 3 days running,
right,
so
yeah.
we could catch these things. Representative Barr.
Thank you. I just want to make sure I understand the gist of the upcoming amendment. It's on students that cost more than $25,000. It's going to be a reimbursement fund to reimburse money in excess of $25,000?
Ms. Chair, Rep. Barr, yes. And we're only moving $12 million aside to do that each year, and that'll probably result in they'll get about 60% of those costs when you prorate that.
60%. Okay.
I think that's a ballpark figure. Mm-hmm. It won't be, but we don't, at least from my association point of view, don't want to put more than $12 million because you're dragging money out of the general distribution, and it's a balance. And again, this is not a fix. Mm-hmm. This is an adjustment as you folks struggle with the big fix that's coming someday.
And with a 2-year sunset, did you say?
Yes, and you come back here in 05 and see how it worked and if these numbers need to be fixed differently.
Thank you.
Let me pick up Representative Berger and then we'll go down to Barnhart.
Yeah, this is on the same subject, Ozzie. If you said sunset it, see how it works. What are the determining factors? What are you trying to determine that would change this?
Ms. Chair, Representative Berger, what we're always trying to determine is how effectively does this address the concept of the formula that we're trying to move the money where the burden is. And you'll see how accurate it is. And then the other issue is if you had lots of money, you would pay for all of this. And you'd set aside enough to not pay 60% of it, pay for all of it. Because it is a burden that nobody else has in that sense. And so those are the kind. We've had to do this every year since we started building the formula for two reasons. One, factors change, and two, we've never, ever funded at a high enough level to actually pay all the things we think ought to be paid under the formula point of view.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that Representative Berger's question got to most of what I'm interested in, but let me see if I understand this correctly. Under this change, many districts aren't going to really see much difference in their revenue, I'm assuming, but especially a small district that happens to get hit with one or two very high-cost students would see a significant increase in their revenue during the time they were trying to educate those students. Is that a fair statement, would you say, of the likely effect of this kind of a bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that is correct. And I think when you look at the data, that where there are collections of these students, the districts who have a large number of them are going to benefit some. Not, again, it doesn't pay all the bills. They're going to lose the $12 million out of the general purpose, and they're going to get them out here. They come out ahead. The small district who suddenly gets one and hasn't had one is going to benefit a lot. And the issue of the sunset, and again, that's my idea. I don't know if anybody else will agree with it or not, but you can relook at it any session no matter what. I think if you put a sunset in, it draws attention to these are things that ought to be paid attention to, and that we don't have the special ed issue resolved and good answers for everything.
Okay. Representative Bridger.
Yes. Ozzie, I guess in this country, if you are willing to work and get out and get motivated, and you're going to live maybe hopefully a better lifestyle than someone else. But as a member of the state legislature with that cap on, all children in Oregon are exactly the same for us, and their education is just as important. And every time we do anything that encourages one school district to have more funding than another school district, there's that discrepancy in the level of education and programs to be offered. Maybe that's just life, and we can't do anything about it, but it doesn't seem to be a real Oregonian philosophy that the district that is a wealthier district that is able to go out for the local options. And maybe that won't be the end of it. Maybe there'll be other bond measures and so forth, and create more and more money in their school system, and comparing it to Reedsport down in my district, where the unemployment is high and very unlikely maybe they can go for a local option. That direction concerns me greatly, in that it seems to move so far away from every child getting the same kind of education and opportunities in Oregon. I'm torn, because I believe that local people should have a right to make local decisions. And so could you comment on that direction and where that's going to finally lead us?
Ms. Chair, Representative Berger, the term local, philosophically, if everything was right, everybody would have adequate resources to get what their kids need. Every kid would have the same opportunities. Probably that isn't going to exist for a variety of reasons, in terms of geography and interest, etc. But the when you get down to the practical issue, the term local option means difference. Once we decided we could have local options, and you're going to have some differences, you need to restrict that in the name of equity. And you need to have a base and then local option. Now, how much local option are you willing to allow? And you're going to look at something today, I think HCR 18 is up on the floor today, and it's a step in an area where we don't do anything for poor districts or smaller districts in the area of supporting efforts in buildings. And the state needs to, and we've said this ever since we started on this road in 1991, we need to set up a system in which not only do we try to equalize and support equal opportunity on the operations side, but we need to do the same thing on the infrastructure side. And this is the first big step we've taken in that direction. I don't believe that the cap, we had a cap, and you're adjusting that cap a little bit. In our view, that cap doesn't get outside the range of what's an acceptable difference. Now, we don't have enough base. We need to build the base. That's true. But this changing this cap still leaves you with a cap that keeps it within an acceptable difference.
Well,
sure.
I guess the thing that concerns me is that every time we do things like HJR 18 and now raising the cap on the local option, someone could say, well, you've done it all. You've the state has really helped, and they've really done what they needed to do. And we still haven't funded the quality education. We don't have programs in our schools. And even the formula is not addressing what we need in the declining enrollment in the schools. And I just think that we just aren't grabbing hold of this entire problem in education. And we just are sending out these bills that are doing little things instead of trying to really get to the core of the problem and solve it. And I know that geography makes a difference, but I do believe as a state legislator, I have to be as responsible for the child in Enterprise, Oregon, as I do the child in Lake Oswego.
Mr. Chair, is that a question or can I
make
comment?
Make a comment or ignore it.
Ms. Chair, Richard, you're correct. I agree. We should solve Oregon's problem, not just for education, but for Oregon Public Broadcasting and a variety of things that I think are important to our state. We aren't capable of solving the big problem for a variety of reasons, and for over a decade, we've been making little tweaks to try to make things work better, always talking about someday we're going to solve, and I still think someday we are. But until you do that, you're forced to try to make things work a little bit better. And that's all, and I start out with this, none of these are answers. There are adjustments that we believe will make things work a little bit better.
I think, fair comment, both of you are here testifying, I think, in support of both of these bills. And in fact, you represent that statewide constituency of big districts and small districts, and all the folks are going to be affected by the impacts of these bills in HGR 18. And I think that's significant, that you do represent that broad constituency of districts, big and small, urban and rural.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and sometimes when I stand up in front of my constituents, I wear a flak jacket.
Mm-hmm. As do we. Representative Farr, you have a question.
Yeah, thank you. I was working on a bill similar to Senate Bill 819, and when I discovered the momentum that this was receiving, I backed off because I figured we'd be seated over here. My bill would have contained a sunset. Has any discussion that you're aware of been turned towards sunsetting this? The reason I would like a sunset is because of the comment that came earlier regarding taking the pressure off of the legislature to actually do a longer term fix and a more universal fix.
Mr. Chair, I've not been in discussion for sunset. Was part of the discussion? I'm sorry.
Okay. I just raise that question right here.
You'd have to set it up for, I think some of these you can vote on for
5 years,
3 years or 5 years.
Five.
Yeah, so you'd have to set it out far enough so that stuff that's put in effect could be able to.
Okay,
Representative Barnhart.
I want to make certain that I understand what this limitation applies to. The local option tax, are we simply referring to the increment amount between Measure 5 and Measure 50? Is that the only thing we're talking about?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Barnhart, yes. I tried the other idea. Let's go for the outside, but...
Does this apply...
Fly much.
Another, if I may, follow-up. How many school districts does this actually apply to? Let me sort of preface the question by saying that in the districts that I'm most familiar with, the amount of money between 5 and 50 is so small that it doesn't come anywhere near the 10% number. How many districts would the 15% number actually apply to? How many dollars are we talking about? It's not very many, is it?
Mr. Chair,
as to today and years hence?
It'll grow in the future, but I don't have the answer. I'm sorry, I don't have the answer to that. John's looking at numbers. Do you have it there? No, I'm sorry, I don't have it.
At least for the immediate future, it's not very much, is it?
No, it's not very much. That's correct.
All right. John Marshall.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, good morning. John Marshall, representing the Oregon School Boards Association. Just a couple of comments in addition to what Ozzy said. It's been, over the last decade, extremely difficult to try to balance the interests of 198 school districts when we make decisions relative to the state school fund distribution formula. What we've tried to do in developing the formula was recognize that school districts are, in fact, different, and that if there were equal numbers of students with equal number of special needs distributed equally across the state, we wouldn't need a distribution formula. We could just distribute state funds on a per-student basis. But we've recognized that there are differences, and what the formula tries to do is to allocate resources that identify those differences, particularly as those differences relate to the numbers and types of students you have. Last legislative session, you requested that the Department of Education, as well as a formal task force, study both special education and small schools, looking for data that would either justify the way that we were distributing money to school districts for special education need students, as well as the small schools. And those studies came back and suggested that in small schools there was a problem, because for some small schools you were sending too much money, and for other small schools you were sending too little. And one of the driving forces behind those differences was transportation costs, and the fact that for some school districts they had extraordinarily high transportation costs. So of the portion that you were, of the portion of the state school fund you were distributing to those small school districts, too large a portion was being eaten up because of their remoteness, their distances, and therefore those higher than normal transportation costs. So the piece in Senate Bill 550 attempts to get at that particular issue. On the special education side, during the interim, we released a study that we asked Eco Northwest to prepare to try to get a handle on why Oregon per student spending on K-12 education appeared to be higher than our neighboring states. And the results of that study indicated that we have higher than average expenditures on special education. And we drilled down into that, and much of that has to do with the facilities that are located here, and many parents with students with special needs want to come here because of OHSU and other facilities to help those to help their students. But what we also recognized is that particularly for a small school district, the fact that a parent with a student that with extraordinarily high cost needs moves into a school district, you can affect almost bankrupt that school district. And that's occurred, I think, up in Washington County with a small school district and a group home for high cost special needs students moved in. So the issue is, how can we attempt to try to balance those special or high cost special education costs among those school districts? And what the provision of Senate Bill 550 does, I think, is create a risk pool that says we're going to take some money and set it aside inside the state school fund distribution formula, so that regardless of where the school district is located, if one of these high-cost students move in, that the school district will be expected to pay upwards of, as Ozzie suggested, $25,000, but any amount in excess, all school districts in the state would share. So in effect, you have every school district in the state that's contributing to this pool, and then it will be used to meet those, the needs or the education costs of those extraordinarily high-cost students. And we think that's rational and one that all school districts would support. On the local option, and I wish Representative Verger were here, because I believe what we've dealt with over the last decade is an issue of equalization. That is, with the passage of Measure 5, the state taking over the responsibility of funding schools and threats of lawsuits, the legislature undertook to try to equalize resources. And we've done that. It took us 7 or 8 years to complete it, but now the funds that you allocate, as well as local formula revenue, is equalized across school districts. So every student is essentially receiving the same amount of money. A couple years ago, there was a discussion about should local school districts be able to enhance the amount that the state provides, and the legislature enacted a local option, and we believe that that's appropriate. And we believe it's appropriate because, as I said, school districts are different. They have different needs, and there ought to be some ability to connect those needs back to a local community. And I think one of the tragedies of Measure 5 is the fact that we've eliminated that connection. And I think the political dynamic has changed. We look at 198 school districts, and this year 13 of them are operating with local option revenue. Many more school districts have attempted a local option in their communities have not been successful. It's a difficult challenge, asking citizens in your community to raise their dreaded property taxes to support school programs. But I believe the dynamic has changed because of the inadequacy of school funding, I don't think that's going to change dramatically over the next couple of years. And I think when citizens in their community are faced with the loss of electives, increase in class sizes, elementary music and middle school sports and high school activities, then they're going to rise up and say, we want to do something about that. And I think local communities ought to be able to make that kind of decision locally. And so the question I think before you is, given that we've equalized school district resources, is there an acceptable level of disparity? And when you enacted the local option, you said, yes, there is. And that disparity happens to equal $500 per student, or 10% of the school district's general operating revenue. And now we're coming back and asking you to reconsider that level of disparity and enhance it so it's, rather than 500, it's 750 per student, or rather than 10%, it's 15%. And given where we are in this economic environment and where schools are going to be relative to their funding, we believe that's an acceptable level of disparity and that it has not violated your commitment to equalize school district resources. The next challenge, in my view, however, is dealing with equity. And we have not dealt with equity. Oftentimes it's called the equity formula, or if you make any changes to the distribution formula, you're violating the principles of equity. I don't believe we're there yet. I believe that we've equalized resources, but in terms of equity, I define as assuring that there are adequate resources behind every child, regardless of where they live, which school district they live, the wealth of their local community, to provide them with a quality educational program. And in one school district, that might be higher order math with a teacher. In another school district, it might be access to higher order math classes over the internet or distance learning. But the issue of equity is assuring that every child has that equal access. And while we've dealt with the issue of equalization of resources, I think the challenge for equity in educational programs across the state has eluded us. None of these changes are the silver bullet. They're simply small steps that we think improve the current circumstance in terms of how we distribute funds, and as well as creating an enhanced option for those school districts that choose to seek approval of a local option. The small high school mergers, the two school districts that were really driving this amendment, North Douglas and Yonkala, they're two relatively small school districts in North Douglas County that I believe that are talking about merging, and as it was suggested, we want to create an incentive and not a disincentive for that to occur. Enterprise and Joseph over the last year or so have also discussed merging, and because of the threat of the loss of the additional small school or small high school funding, are interested in this as well. And I think there are other areas of the state where, because of the financial circumstances, there may be a desire to look at merging, and we don't want to put any barriers in the way for those folks to be able to do that. In conclusion, Mr. Chairman, these are not simple issues. And I wish that we could look at a variety of distribution formula changes and the needs of individual school districts and the needs of groups of individual school districts, and really take a hard look at the formula. And I believe that distribution formula changes would be a lot easier were we putting more money into the pot. But the pot is shrinking, and what we're trying to do is be fair in terms of how we distribute that pot out to 198 school districts. And we believe that the formula changes before you are reasonable, they're rational, and ones that you should seriously consider. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be glad to respond to any questions.
All right. Questions for Mr. Marshall? All right. Thank you very much. I know you'll be in the room the rest of the day and probably tomorrow, too, in case we have more for you. Steve, this might be a good time to walk us through. Oh, no. Let's pick up Representative McPherson. Okay. Yeah. Sorry, Dick. Yeah. Then let's talk about the schedule.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Representative Greg McPherson from District 38. And I'm coming to speak in favor of Senate Bill 819, the local option increase. This is a relatively modest bill, but I think it's moving us a direction that we need to move. I draw my experience with the issue of school funding from my background as a native Oregonian. I grew up in rural Linn County, and I went to a two-room country schoolhouse through the sixth grade. The Oakville school had about 25 kids in total. The total staff consisted of two teachers, one of whom doubled as the principal, and a part-time custodian. And that rural district drew its support and oversight from the local people who lived in that community and made a decision about what programs they wanted to have. And they did that school did a pretty good job drawing on that local involvement and support. And I think that while I am a strong supporter of the equalization of resources generally across the state in education, I think that's been a positive move. I think it has moved us too far that direction. We're losing that connection between local communities and their local schools. And to the extent that we can, in some measure, restore that connection, I think we will have accomplished a good thing. I can't speak nearly as authoritatively on the mechanics of the equalization formula as John Marshall and Ozzie Rose can. They have tremendous history with these issues, and I would defer to their description. But I would just like to press the point that we need to restore a connection between localities and their schools and the decisions that are made there. That we've gone so far the other direction, and it has become such a source of tension and frustration for people out in the communities who want to do more for their schools and who find they can't, and frankly, they vilify us as legislators for preventing them from doing that. The people in my district say we want to tax ourselves to provide more for our schools because we have value certain programs, and they see the legislature as preventing them from doing this. And this bill is not a big bill. It doesn't add a lot to the local option property tax levy, but it adds something, and I think it moves us in the direction of helping to restore that connection between the locality and the local school. So with those words, I can answer any questions.
Representative Barnhart.
Thank you. Representative, I asked this question earlier, and I think it was before you got here, about the actual effect of this bill. I know that the districts I'm most familiar with, we will not get any change because of this bill, because the difference between the amount of the local option is too small, or the amounts that are available. Are any of the districts in your legislative district in a different situation where they're actually bumping up against this 10% limit? And would actually benefit from this bill?
Mr. Chair, Representative Barnhart, that is the case. Because this is not a constitutional limit, it doesn't affect the Measure 5 and Measure 50 limits, so that it is really only enabling districts to take advantage of whatever difference exists between the limit on the local option amount that they're permitted to raise without it cutting into equalization of state resources and what would otherwise apply under Measure 5. In the Lake Oswego School District, there is a difference there, and it's an amount of $2 million either per year or per biennium. And if I were more on top of my game, I would be able to tell you which, but it is $2 million within some period that the Lake Oswego School District can raise with the passage of this bill, because there is that difference. And I understand there's some districts that don't have that opportunity.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will probably support this because I think it is a stopgap measure. I was a little concerned about the comparison and the insinuation, if you will, that it's a direction in which we ought to be going in the bigger picture. And I guess I would say to you, what about the kids who live in communities that don't want to tax themselves? Don't we create a much wider gap?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, I think it's a valid concern that there are some communities within the state that have the resources, therefore the capability, and the willingness to generate more for their schools than other communities. And as I indicated earlier, I think that the general move to equalization of school resources across the state is a good thing. That is, to not have some districts that are doing very well and others that are closing for lack of resources. That disparity, I think, is very troublesome. The question is whether it's the desirable to go to a situation where we have such rigid uniformity that we can't reflect the differences and aspirations of different communities. And it happens that within my district there are some school districts that have, I would have to say, very high aspirations for what they expect from their public schools. And if the public schools can't deliver that, people will and have already to some extent abandoned public education. So I see this as being a modest safety valve that allows for the local variations on top of a base that's uniform. And I think that you will find that the people who live in my district will continue to be, as long as they are engaged in public education because they haven't abandoned the public schools, they will be vigorous advocates of statewide funding solutions in addition, because their aspirations for what public schools can do are so strong and so well developed that I think you'll find that they will advocate for resources for Enterprise and for Tillamook and for Roseburg and all of the communities of the state.
Yeah, I'm not too concerned about anyone mistaking this for the big fix.
Throw in a few zeros, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you, Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Jim Scherzinger, you come in. I know you had an inclined to testify on these, so welcome back, Mr. Superintendent.
Still sounds funny, doesn't it?
Yeah.
I'm Jim Scherzinger, Superintendent at Fordham Public Schools, and I'm here to testify in favor of the two bills before you. I'll talk primarily about because I think I've been before this committee before, talking about the local option, and I know you have a limited amount of time, primarily about the special ed, high needs special ed bill. I think the key thing about this is that I believe that this is a move toward better equalization in our state school fund formula. There are many districts in the state, including Portland, where the statistics show that we spend substantially more on special ed costs than the current allocation. And I believe that looking to a change in the formula so that it recognizes that some districts, both urban and rural districts, face much higher costs with some kids, actually improves the equalization of the system. I think in our case, the numbers show that we spend about $17 million more than our allocation on special ed. I think the other thing to recognize that, if anything, that we're losing ground with respect to special ed, that the governor's budget that is proposed and the conversations down in Ways and Means are talking about reducing funding for things like regional programs, that those are kind of funny budget cuts, because if you make those budget cuts, the programs don't actually go away, because the responsibility for the program under federal law actually falls on the school district. So if you cut those expenditures, the school districts that have to then fund them. We can't actually cut the program because the services are mandated. Second thing to recognize there is that as we cut budgets, and we have cut budgets over the last few years due to the shortage of revenue at the state, that the school districts that have to make those reductions have to maintain the services under the maintenance of benefits requirements for special ed, so that the costs of special ed are actually growing as a share of our budget, because even though our funding is being reduced. In other words, what happens is that as the state suffers its budget problems and reduces the state school fund allocations, that proportionately the special ed allocation falls, but we can't really cut those programs. The best we can do is not spend any more on them, and so the share of special ed costs tend to rise within the budget. I think this represents at least a small move in the area of getting greater equalization in the system for special ed costs. So that's the primary message I'd like to bring. I'd be glad to answer any questions about the rest of the provisions in the bill.
All right, thank you. Questions for Mr. Scherzinger, Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still trying to understand how this high-cost special ed formula would work. Do you believe that this would result in a net increase in state funding for the Portland School District?
I believe that as the bill is written now, and I understand that, you know, the specifics are really sensitive. I mean, you can change the numbers a little bit, and then the numbers change a lot. But, yes, it would, is my understanding.
On the other hand, the transportation grant piece would reduce?
Right. There is a combination of things in here that the rural transportation, the high school change, well, that doesn't really shift anything directly, but the rural transportation piece of the bill would shift funds away from us. But I believe the net effect of the special ed piece is that it would increase our allocation because we do have a disproportionate number of high-cost special ed kids, primarily due to the location of hospital facilities and those kinds of services in the city.
Right. And to put it a different way, right, those are statewide responsibilities that happen to clump in Portland because that's where OHSU is.
Right. And there are other reasons why there are many other districts that have those kinds of high costs, but that's sure our primary reason.
Other questions? All right. Thank you very much. All right. We have a couple more signed up that we haven't brought up yet today, and that's Lori Wimmer-Whalen and Catherine White, W-E-I-T. I wasn't sure of that third letter.
Good morning, committee members, and Mr. Chair. For the record, Lori Wimmer-Whalen with the Oregon Education Association, here representing 44,000 teachers and classified personnel in Oregon's public schools. And we're here in support of both bills, Senate Bill 550 and 819, because we believe that they represent good public policy rationales rather than political rationales and deserve passage for those concepts, particularly as a package deal and as a compromise among the various options that have been proposed with respect to the distribution formula and the small tweaks, as it were, as you've heard so much about. One of the points I thought I'd make is that with respect to 819, the local option bump of the actual amount from 500 to 750, a good proportion of that is simply inflation since the original law was passed in 1999. And so there is rationale for doing it simply to keep pace with your original intention from when the bill was passed originally. We also believe that keeping it within the Measure 5 and 50 gap amount is better than going outside it for these times because we worry about voter confusion with respect to a long-term funding solution. We don't want a misperception out there in the public that that a local option fix supplants the need for any other kind of fix with respect to the school funding crisis in Oregon. And so we see this as a better option among the various proposals for that reason. We would note that of Oregon's 198 school districts, 50 districts have attempted to pass a local option, and of those, 17 have succeeded. And only three of those who failed were failed because of a lack of a turnout in an off-year election. And I think that's a significant number only because the viability of local option is certainly a concern, and I wanted to validate that. There are districts that, because of low property wealth on a per-student basis, will never really be able to turn to this option. And to some extent, we're happy to say that the passage of Ballot Measure 1, which OEA worked for very hard, which provides a power-equalized local option for I would say, the middle-class districts, so to speak, those that aren't high property wealth but who have some commitment to educational opportunity for their students and would like to try to go out, have, with the state match aspect to the Ballot Measure 1 power-equalized local option, some power assist, if you will, from the state that helps more districts consider this a viable option, I think, especially over time as the recession finally goes away. We also believe that the language in 819 that provided the incentive for the small district merger may result in some economic efficiencies for the small district and will send money there that otherwise wouldn't be available. And so that helps solve another chunk of the district's financial problems. Not solve it, I should say that differently. Helps ameliorate some of the tragedy of the losses that we're looking at with respect to budget cuts. We think that taken together, this package, therefore, does offer some sort of a modest compromise in these times. And we would urge you to remember, as you tell your colleagues about it, should you vote to pass these two bills out, that these are not a substitute for a decent K-12 budget for 2003-05, much less a long-term funding fix, but that they are necessary tweaks in terms of redistributing scarce resources where they are best spent. We all know that, of course, making the resources less scarce is the ultimate objective, and we would certainly not argue that these go by any way to do that. We do fear that without these kinds of measures in place, that in some of the higher wealth areas, so-called, such as the Portlands and Bee Rittens and Lake Oswego's of the world, Tiger Twaltons, what have you, that if we don't offer some of these local option fixes that are a little healthier than what we have on the books now, that we will lose some of our best public school supporters who are now boosters, who help, who come down and speak to all of you on a regular basis, who also help pass their local option levies and bond levies, and who do everything they can to help support their schools from bake sales to gift wrap sales to what have you. That they will finally lose their steam and give up and enroll their children in private schools to the detriment of public schools everywhere. And so I would just add that to the arguments that have already been made as far as why we think it's necessary to do whatever it is we can. And I'll close with one final thought, and that is others keep saying what we really need is a long-term fix, and I will remind you that you are the origination point for this building for that hope. Thank you.
Ms. White.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I'm with the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. And I'm here in support of the Senate Bill 550. Family advocates of children with disabilities have long recognized the problems presented by high-cost children in the schools. This high-cost fund was a recommendation of the Special Education Task Force. And we support an effort to look at that very seriously, urge you to pass it. Family advocates have observed basically three drivers of cost, and the instructional needs of the child clearly being one of the drivers of cost, a recognition that very aggressive parents are also drivers of cost. And inappropriate and often incompetent instruction can also be drivers of cost, particularly around kids with high cost needs and with very intense educational needs. We have very minimal data on these high cost kids. We have a lot of anecdotal data. We don't have a lot of data on actually what is working, what do these kids need, and what are some of the most effective strategies. We know from anecdotal data that a child presenting with similar disabilities may have very widely different costs depending on the school district. And so a lot of this needs to be analyzed. We are very supportive of this approach. We support Mr. Rose's proposal that we do a sunset on this. And take a look at it during the interim to see exactly what is the best approach to addressing these students. As the family advocates, we're real committed to working both with the department on the rules and the procedures for looking at this, and we'll do what we can from the private sector to assist the department in really doing very accurate analysis of what those costs are and what the best strategies are. We're dealing with many children that schools are not prepared necessarily to deal with, and we need to take advantage of the best practice that is out there and share it with other school districts so that we can statewide address the needs of these children.
Okay. Thank you. Ms. White, questions for either of these witnesses? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Laurie, I have a question to ask you. I too like the idea of the small high schools being able to merger and to keep the small school funding. I wonder if you feel that that also could flow over to the problem of the declining enrollment schools that could possibly get their full funding for over a period of 4 years until they could adjust to that severe loss of 112 students all at one time.
Mr. Chair and Representative Verger, there's a possibility. It would depend on which small schools, which declining enrollment schools we're talking about, whether or not they would qualify under the terms of this, but it's certainly a possibility. I think that you raise a good point that among the various different problems that plague schools in the scarcity environment, particularly precipitous drops in enrollment are a huge issue, and we do need to work on that if this isn't the fix.
Other questions? Okay, thank you very much. That's all we have signed up to testify. Does anybody else want to come forward today? Again, this will be up tomorrow as well. I hope we see some amendments. Brian Reeder, come on up. And then Steve, before we finish, I'll have you walk us through the numbers that you've distributed to us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Brian Reeder, Department of Education. Just very briefly, wanted to indicate that the department does support both these bills, but primarily I came up to try to shed a little more light on the questions that Representative Barnhart has asked about the local option, and that is, does it really have any effect? The answer is yes and no.
Thank you very much.
There are.
What law school did you go to, Brian?
I'm not an actor, and I don't play one on TV. Nor am I a lawyer. What we found with local options is that there's really a great deal of uncertainty out there about how much districts will raise with a given tax rate. And the reason that is because of the interaction between Measure 50 and Measure 5. Measure 50 imposes taxes on assessed value. Measure 5's limit is on market value. And the compression that occurs under Measure 5 is done on a property-by-property basis. What we're finding is that the difference between the Measure 50 amount raised and the limit imposed by Measure 5 varies tremendously from property to property. When you impose a given tax rate, it will force some properties into compression, but other properties not. And what we found, districts have gone out with a given tax rate. They've done their calculations based on averages, which really implicitly assumes that the room under the Measure 5 cap is the same for every property. The fact that that's not true has resulted in districts raising only about a third to a half of what they expected from a given tax rate, given local option tax rate. What I've been doing recently is helping districts to make better estimates of what tax rate they need to raise a given amount of revenue, and what that involves is looking at every property in a school district and sort of simulating what the Measure 5 limit would do under the imposition of a given tax rate. Recently, I have worked with the Beaverton School District, who has a local option on the ballot, I believe, this month or maybe sometime soon, and they were potentially bumping up against the $500 or 10% limit in about 3 years. They're going for a five-year levy, but about 3 years out in the tax rate that they were thinking about imposing, they could bump up against that limit if real market values start growing again at, you know, roughly 3 or 4% a year. What that led them to do was scale back the tax rate that they put on the ballot, and so they're going to raise less money than they really wanted to, because they're afraid that they would exceed those limits, and that any additional revenue beyond the limits would flow into the formula, which is really a huge giveaway for any local district, and something to be avoided. This would give them a little more room. They would not face that problem in this particular levy that they're putting on the ballot, although this bill may be too late for them. But it's a similar problem that a number of districts will face as real market values begin to grow a little bit as we come out of this recession. if we ever come out of this recession, they will start bumping up against those limits. I think the key point is here, there's a lot of uncertainty out there about how much a given tax rate will raise, so they don't really know with any great degree of certainty what tax rate to impose, to ask their voters for, because they don't really know how much money it's going to raise. And this really would give them a little more breathing room so that they wouldn't have to send money through the formula if they, for whatever reason, you know, go above the limits.
Okay. And that gets kind of back to the discussion that the number today will be different than the number in 5 years as to what districts have room within that gap amount to take advantage of that increase.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Also, Brian, a good point that you make, though, that technically that limit doesn't disallow a local option above that. It simply means that if you happen to misjudge and exceed the current cap, then that money is captured by the formula and redistributed statewide, which is a disincentive for local districts.
Representative Chitter, that's correct, and it really, I think, doesn't play well with local voters when they send their what they thought would be local dollars back through the formula, and I think that's a real problem. When
yeah.
That's also an understatement.
Yeah. Representative Hobson.
Thank you. It would play real well in my district, so feel free to encourage that. I have a couple of questions that I don't expect you to have the answers to right now, although knowing you, you easily could have them in your back pocket. The number of students that are going to be in these categories of high-cost special ed kids. I realize we're somewhat looking at the 25,000 as a specific figure, but how that relates to 4 times, 5 times, 6 times in that piece. And also the number of schools that would any stretch of the imagination be eligible for maintaining the 4-year extension on the small school correction if they were in fact to look at a merger.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hobson, I try not to keep numbers in my head because they get all mixed up, and so I'm sorry, I don't have specific numbers for you, but we can provide those.
Maybe they'd be good to hear back on tomorrow.
And I had one final point, which escaped me, but is now coming back. With regard to the local option, as Representative Barnhart correctly pointed out, this doesn't have a big effect now because the real limit on what districts can raise with local options now is really the Measure 5 limit, not the $500 or the 10%, but as market values grow, the Measure 5 limit is really eased, and those other the 500 and 10% come into play.
Okay. Thank you very much. Steve, do you want to walk us through the illustration that you have presented to us?
Mr. Chair, in the Senate Bill 550 packet, you do have one short table labeled School Transportation Grant.
Attached to the revenue impact statement?
Correct. At the end, at the back of that packet. What you have there is the ranking of the school districts by transportation cost per student, per ADM, not per ADMW. That makes a significant difference. And it shows you then what the transportation cost is per student. So at the top of the list is in Malheur County, Gentura 12, a little over $5,000 per student. You can see what the 70% grant would give that district per student for ADM. And then what Senate Bill 550A would do when you bump it up to 90% from 70% for that district. And then it shows the gain and the gain per student. So you can see that the total there is $1 million in terms of additional funds going into the transportation grant that then would come from the general purpose grant, and it would be on average about $158 per student. Now, there are two districts in this list that shows a transportation increase, but their overall revenue wouldn't be affected because they don't qualify for state school fund dollars because of their local revenue being higher than the formula amount. So that's where the number 750 or so came from, I think, that Ozzy was using. But in the grant side of it, it would be close to $1 million. And so you have the 38
highest districts. There are 19, the first 19 getting their transportation grant ramped up to 90%, the next 19 to 80%. Okay. There was one other sheet that I included just for your information as kind of background material for Senate Bill 550. It's probably too much detail, but it will give you a feel for, it's labeled K-12 special education. It will give you some idea of the numbers of students in the various categories of special education. There's 11 or 12 of them there. And you can then see which of those are highest, high incidence versus low incidence. So as you go from left to right across the page, you go from high incidence to low incidence for these. It will show you what their placement is in terms of where they get the majority of their education program located, whether it's in the regular classroom, resource room, separate classroom, or other facility. And then you have the statewide totals, and you also have a breakout by size of district, so that if you want to go in there and compare what the percentage of the students are by placement, by size of district, you can do that, and you'll see that the higher or the larger districts tend to have a higher percent of their special education students located either in a separate classroom or, well, even a resource room, a separate classroom, or other facility. So you can, if you work through the comparisons, you can see how that works out, and it tends to support the view that the larger districts tend to have a higher percentage of the higher cost special education students.
Okay. You're right. There's a lot of numbers on that.
Yes.
All right. Before we wrap this up today, and again, we'll have this up tomorrow. Does anybody else want to come forward? Let me just ask, if you've got some amendments that you're proposing, it'd be nice if we could see those tomorrow so that we can have at least some committee discussion on proposed amendments and then either take action or else at least be educated on it to take action on Thursday. And you'll have some more tables. Good. Something to look forward to. With that, then, I think I will close the public hearing on both Senate Bill 819 and Senate Bill 550. And, committee, we are adjourned.